Hi, this is Matthew Craig. Welcome to the Allegheny Front. Some conservative members of Congress would like to see the Endangered Species Act put on the extinction list. The DuPont Company is discovering that the chemical that makes Teflon is actually sticking to the groundwater around their plant on the Ohio-West Virginia border. Now tens of thousands of local residents will be tested for adverse health effects in what could be the largest public screening in U.S. history. We'll go exploring on the Lake Erie Islands, and the Felician Sisters of Coriopolis are leading by example in our next installment of Religion, Spirituality, and the Environment. That's all coming your way, but first, let's check in with our news desk. Joining us now from the Allegheny Front Newsroom is our weekly news analyst, Lisa Ann Pinkerton. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks, Matthew.
We discussed a proposed bill last fall that Governor Rendell recently signed into law. The new law, which is called ACRE, which stands for Agriculture, Communities, and Rural Environment. Lisa, what is the need for this bill?
Well, primarily, this is an issue of large-scale animal feeding operations and the local governments where they're located.
Now, some people may know these operations as factory farms. Mm-hmm. These are large-scale farms. Now, they don't tend to operate with traditional farming techniques. So let's talk about, just briefly, how are they run?
These farms house hundreds of animals, and so problems come into play when the farms need to dispose of the manure that's created, hundreds of pounds every day. And a common way to dispose of the manure is to spray it over the fields for fertilizer. However, problems occur when it runs off into local waterways. The organization Penn Future says that for the last 3 years, Pennsylvania has seen at least 10 manure spills, leaks, and other pollution incidents, and these incidences contaminated streams and groundwater. So the neighbors of factory farms must also endure the health hazards from air pollution and the odors that permeate from the farms. And finally, they say that the farms reduce their property value because no one would choose to live near them.
As a result of all this, several local governments have enacted ordinances to regulate and protect their citizens from these factory farms. And as you would expect, large farming operations often disagree with the regulations imposed on them.
Right. And this bill seeks to strike a compromise and also to save farmers and local governments from court costs associated with suing one another. So the law offers a process for the parties to have their dispute reviewed by the state attorney general's office. The office can then bring action in the Commonwealth Court if it thinks a local ordinance is possibly overstepping its bounds. Then court costs and fees would be placed on the winning party.
In its original form, the bill would have used an appointed board to review local regulations. Many environmentalists and local governments opposed this.
Yes, and they said it was giving an unelected board power to overrule ordinances approved by elected local officials.
Now that the Attorney General's office is saddled with that power, are they less opposed to the idea?
Perhaps slightly less opposed. Tom Lindsay is with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, mm-hmm. and he accuses ACRE of, quote, coming awfully close to violating the state constitution.
Now, why does he think that?
Well, he sees it as a separation of power issue. He said, quote, we have the legislature screwing around with executive and judicial branches, end quote. Mm. But when I spoke with Jan Jarrett of Penn Future, she seems to think this wouldn't really be a priority for the attorney general's office, saying, quote, I don't think he'll relish picking local fights in conservative rural Pennsylvania when he has to stand for election again. But she also mentions that ACRE prohibits local governments from enacting ordinances that limit agriculture, and that it unnecessarily expands state government and creates two arenas for litigation that, in her view, are biased in favor of industrial-scale livestock operations.
But the law would attempt to address some odor problems, right?
That's true. That's true. The bill does not limit local ordinances that regulate the use of sewer sludge as fertilizer. And it steps up new standards for odor control when new farming operations are set up or expanded. Also, it prohibits the spreading of manure within 100 feet of surface water.
Now, factory farms could still spread manure over their land as fertilizer if they establish a 35-foot vegetative buffer.
Yes, that's right.
It sounds like the bill that passed is improved over the bill we covered last fall at the introduction of this.
It is. Although Penn Future still wants to make improvements, they say that there's a real interest amongst legislators to create legal distinctions between traditional farms and industrial livestock facilities. They also plan to work on legislation that would ban the use of antibiotics in animal feed because they think ACRE really won't solve anything.
Well, thank you, Lisa, for bringing us up to date on this issue.
You're welcome, Matthew.
And with Lisa Ann Pinkerton, I'm Matthew Craig, and you're listening to The Allegheny Front. The Endangered Species Act protects plants and animals that are on the brink of extinction. The American bald eagle and the timber wolf are examples of animals that have recovered because of the act. But some conservative members of Congress think the Endangered Species Act goes too far. They say the law often stands in the way of economic progress and private property rights. The Great Lakes Radio Consortium's Mark Brush has this story.
The piping plover is a tiny little bird. It's not much bigger than a parakeet. This plover scurries around on the beach. It's making a distress call and showing a broken wing display because it's nervous about a group of people who are building a cage around its nest. But the people are here to help. They're trying to protect its nest. Plovers build their nests out of little round stones right on the beach. Amanda Brushhaber is a biological technician with the National Park Service. She's leading a group of volunteers who are working to save this rare little bird.
Right now, we're exclosing the nests that have eggs in them. The exclosures keep the predators out and keep the birds of prey out so that the eggs have a chance of making it to hatch, which takes 28 days.
These birds are getting help because they were put on the endangered species list back in 1986. At one point, there were only 11 breeding pairs left in the Great Lakes region. The birds like wide sandy beaches that have strips of stones and cobble. But these shorelines have been under a lot of development pressure, and with more buildings and more people on the beaches, the birds had a tough time surviving. The piping plover is just one of the more than 1,800 plants and animals that are protected by the Endangered Species Act. The act has been around for more than 30 years. It's considered the strongest law in the world in protecting endangered plants and animals. And for the most part, it's remained unchanged since it was first passed. But some members of Congress think the Endangered Species Act goes too far. They say enforcement of the act is often heavy-handed, to the point that it's an abuse of federal power. California Congressman Richard Pombo chairs the House Committee on Resources. He's a vocal critic of the act. Brian Kennedy is a spokesperson for Congressman Pombo and his committee. He says the congressman's constituents are afraid of finding an endangered species on their land because it could limit how they use their land.
In other words, if the federal government finds an endangered species on a fraction of an individual's private property, he loses the use of that property, and then when that individual goes to sell it, it is worth less than it would be otherwise.
Private property advocates say they want owners compensated for this loss. Otherwise, they say, their rights to the land are being taken away. They refer to this loss as a taking. But people who enforce the act say there's a lot of misunderstanding about what it means. Jack Dingledine is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says they work closely with landowners to make sure a development won't harm a protected species.
If a landowner finds an endangered species on their property, they do have an obligation not to harm the species when it's there. It doesn't mean that we're going to close beaches and we don't seize people's property, but we would ask that they, you know, consider any actions that might harm the species.
Harming a species includes damaging the place where it lives, even if that habitat is on privately owned land. And this is what makes private property advocates bristle. They see this as an infringement on their rights to do whatever they want with their land. Several bills are being developed that would change the way the act is implemented. The sponsors of these bills say the changes they want to make to the Endangered Species Act will be an improvement. But supporters of the act say these bills do nothing to improve the law. Kieran Suckling is with the Center for Biological Diversity. He says these critics of the Endangered Species Act are hiding their true agenda.
Down the line, these are all industry-sponsored bills that have no purpose other than to get rid of environmental protection to benefit industry, period. They can spin it any way they want, but at the end of the day, that's what their bill says.
Supporters of the Endangered Species Act are troubled by the way Congress has changed its tune. When the act was first passed 32 years ago, Congress voted for it by a 355-4 margin. The law was extremely popular because there was a sense of urgency about protecting endangered plants and animals. Many environmentalists are concerned that if the Endangered Species Act is weakened now, we'll see more wildlife wiped out of existence. For the GLRC, I'm Mark Rush.
You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Matthew Craig. We'd like to hear what you think about The Allegheny Front. Drop us a line. Our email address is info@alleghenyfront.org. Still to come, we'll check in with the Felician Sisters in Coriopolis, who are showing us how to lead by example. Please stay tuned. The non-stick substance Teflon is made at a DuPont plant near the Ohio-West Virginia border. The groundwater around this area is contaminated by a chemical used to make the Teflon. The chemical is known as C8. Now, 60,000 residents will be tested to find out whether the chemical is harmful to human health. It could end up being the largest public health screening to occur in the United States. The Great Lakes Radio Consortium's Fred Kite reports.
The testing is just getting underway on people who've been drinking water contaminated by C8. It's being done as part of the settlement of a class action lawsuit against the company. Residents of nearby water districts accuse the company of withholding information about the health threats posed by C8. Project coordinator Art Mayer says medical histories, personal information, and blood samples will be collected from the test subjects, who will be paid for their participation.
That information then will be fed into a database that ultimately will be passed on to the next step of the settlement agreement, which would be the science panel, who would interpret the data.
If the experts determine there is a link between C8 and any disease, DuPont will be required to spend as much as $235 million on a medical monitoring program for additional testing. For the GLRC, this is Fred Kite.
The Great Lakes Radio Consortium is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the DTE Energy Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can learn more about Great Lakes Radio Consortium stories at glrc.org.
I'm Matthew Craig, and you're listening to The Allegheny Front. Senior citizens are making a big dent in the environmental workforce. So join us next week as we explore this inspiring story about the Senior Environmental Corps and learn how retired engineers, school teachers, and other adults are making a big difference in their world and in ours. So join us next Wednesday at 7 or Saturday morning at 6:30 for that and other environmental news. Now, have you already planned your summer vacation? Summertime vacations can be tricky to organize, but you don't have to hop a plane to the Bahamas to find warm weather and sandy beaches. You may have already discovered that Lake Erie provides all the fun of the Caribbean only a few hours' drive from Pittsburgh. We sent the Allegheny Front's Lisa Ann Pinkerton to the islands of Lake Erie to scout out the opportunities.
There's only one way to get to the Lake Erie Islands, 10 miles off the coast of Sandusky, Ohio. And that's on a boat.
Yeah, I lived in Cleveland for 22 years before I found out there were islands in Lake Erie, so it's just a getaway. It's in Ohio, and I don't know how many people know about it, but I know a lot of people don't. It's a hidden treasure that Ohio has. They didn't even put us on the state quarter, so that's how hidden we are.
That's Beau, first mate on the Miller Boat Line, ferrying people and supplies to the islands. The nine Lake Erie islands range in size from one city block to several square miles. Water activities of all kinds abound here, but fishing is what the area is most famous for.
Yeah, the walleye fishing here is the best in the country, they say. The pro tournament comes here year after year, and they have record catches.
The Bass Islands are aptly named for their abundance of fish. They are the main tourist attractions, green and lush, with calm streams and wide dirt roads running through them, speckled with cottages. South Bass Island is the largest, about 4 square miles. There, the town of Put-in Bay offers every tourist activity and water sport you would expect. A $5 boat ride north takes you to Middle Bass Island, barely a mile long. It's quieter here, with many cottages and only one church, general store, souvenir shop, and two bars. Margie Smith, one of only 40 full-time locals, runs the Middle Bass Post Office out of her home.
I think it takes a special person to live here all year round. A person who doesn't mind not seeing people every day. And the weather here in the summer is beautiful. I guess that's one of the great reasons that, you know, in the wintertime when you're sitting here all by yourself, you know that summer is coming. So
as Memorial Day descends, so do the tourists, over 2,000 a year. Some stay with Jim Britz, a fifth-generation local who runs the Isle de Fleurs cottages on Middle Bass. His ancestors immigrated here from Germany just before the Civil War.
The Isle de Fleurs was the original name of Middle Bass. The French explorers named it that in the 1600s. Most of the settlers from Germany grew grapes before they came here, and so the settlers here then started growing grapes also.
By the turn of the century, the Bass Islands were the winemaking capital of the nation. Visiting the wineries is a popular activity, and Billy Naniger, a 10-year summer visitor, remembers the Middle Bass Winery from his youth.
We used to, when we were underage, just go to the winery and steal wine from people.
Now that Billy and his friends are older, Hazard's Resort is the new gathering place. Anyone can visit the pool, and tourists even boat over from Put-in Bay on South Bass Island to enjoy the tropical oasis. As did this group of ladies, lounging in their bright swimsuits and sun hats. They are soaking up the sun and taking in the daiquiris, while their husbands and children are back on Ohio's mainland.
Well, you can hang out at the pool or rent golf carts. You can go winery. There's the cave. There's shopping, sightseeing. You can do the train tour. You can go up in the monument. And there's great entertainment at night, you know, in the bars, and live music and bands. And there's something for everybody.
Other families stay on Middle Bass and visit Put-in Bay for the activities.
It's nice. It's just very quiet and peaceful and good family place.
Uh-huh. The weather's actually very nice. Uh-huh. It's always nice and sunny over here. We're hoping to maybe go parasailing later.
Living with nature is a big part of the experience on Middle Bass. The lake is full of fish, and the acres of forest and tall trees are perfect for birds and rabbits. You might even sight the occasional snake.
A snake from the lake, I think it just crawled right over here and almost right into the pool.
I like the mayflies, but there's a lot around here. My mommy doesn't like any kind of bugs.
Oh, yeah?
I don't like the mayflies, no.
Just because they're everywhere. They're all over you, and they leave the little black marks everywhere. And
yes, the mayflies are everywhere. For usually up to a month each summer, these inch-long, tall, wispy-winged insects hatch from their eggs at the bottom of the lake. Avoiding fish, they swim to shore, covering every vertical surface they can find. They molt there, and at dusk, they take to the sky to find a mate. Finally, before they die, the females fly over the lake, depositing as many as 8,000 eggs. All this within 72 hours. On the deck of an A-frame cottage, I was having dinner with Billy Naniger and his friend Aaron when that night's mating season began.
They're just kind of flying up and down, so there's so many of them that if you concentrate on a select few, you can see how they kind of dance together in sync. And it's raining now, and I don't think half the raindrops are hitting us.
As they wear out their time of activity for the day, they get tired, and they just start to get lower and lower.
Ew, one's in my food.
Man.
The mayflies are a happy nuisance. Because they only breed in fresh water, their abundance indicates that the water quality of Lake Erie is improving. Back in the 1950s, pollution rendered this lake virtually dead, and the mayflies didn't return until 1994, after 30 years of environmental cleanup. Back at the Isle de Fleurs cottages, lifetime local Brits puts the experience in perspective.
We call them June flies because we have them in June. They're really lasting a long time this year. Some years we only have them for a few days, but we've had them like 2 weeks already now. They don't last forever, you know, so we put up with them, as I say.
Learning to ignore the June flies takes some practice. They flutter in front of your face as you walk through the grass. If lights are left on at night, they will cover the window like a thick fur. Spiders weave huge webs everywhere to catch the June flies. And if a door is left open, even a crack, you will have a dozen new roommates. If only for 72 hours. Back at the pool, the ladies from Put In Bay take it all in stride.
Actually, it's kind of comical now, you know, but our first year we were like, ooh, they're so disgusting. But yeah, now it's comical. It's really comical.
All right, good one.
From the Lake Erie Islands of Ohio, this is Lisa Ann Pinkerton for the Allegheny Front.
Ann Murray visits one of the region's most environmentally sensitive buildings, a recently renovated complex in Moon Township, Pennsylvania. The 72-year-old structure houses the Felician Sisters Convent, Chapel, and High School. The building's $22 million renovation has inspired the sisters and students alike to spread their gospel of green.
Gathered in their chapel for evening prayers, the Felician Sisters of Coriopolis don't look like environmental pioneers, but this small Franciscan community of women is now part of a new eco-friendly movement that may change how buildings are designed and how people relate to buildings. The sisters' transformation began in 2001. That's when they chose to renovate rather than tear down their aging convent and school.
As we began to work with the architects and the construction people, we were led, I think, with their guidance and with what we felt as women religious, we were led to more and more looking at sustainability, preserving what was here.
Sister Mary Cabrini-Procopio says as the planning process continued, the sisters decided not only to preserve the character of their Gothic building, but to make it green. Green buildings make up a small but growing niche in the building market. They're designed and constructed to be environmentally and people-friendly. Values that parallel Franciscan tradition, says Sister Mary Cabrini.
We ascribed to those values because we care for creation, we care about the environment, we care what the world of tomorrow is going to become, and we see our part in that as a responsibility to working toward bringing that about.
To carry out the sisters' mission of environmental stewardship, their architects and builders mixed new technology with salvaged materials. After the building's three wings were reconfigured, contractors reused original hardwood floors, trim, and door frames. They covered walls with low toxic paint and laid tile made from recycled airplane glass. The sisters also chose to experiment with alternative energy systems.
So, these are our 12 solar panels making hot water for us.
Sister Mary Alexander Klawinski points to a bank of solar panels perched on the convent roof. The panels absorb sunlight and generate enough energy to heat the building's water.
We're using less energy now because it's partially heated with these panels, and by the time it gets downstairs, there's less energy needed to bring it up to the 100 and some degrees that's necessary.
Contractors project the renovated building will use 30% less energy and generate far less carbon dioxide. But equally important to this community of 75 sisters and 300 students are the changes the green renovation has already made in their daily lives. Sister Mary Alexis is one of about 20 elderly sisters in the convent's window-filled dining room. There are now hundreds of large, energy-efficient windows throughout the building. They've improved utility bills and outlooks.
Prior to our moving here, I was in a place where I couldn't see too much because I'm short and the window was high. And if I did look out, there was a building. But when I saw my room that had two windows, I saw trees and grass, I was overjoyed. Yes.
The renovation has made other rooms brighter and wheelchair accessible. And the design has allowed small groups of the women to live together in households with common space that affords lots of daily interaction. As she finishes her lunch, Sister Mary Augustine beams about the change.
And it made me feel younger.
How did the renovations make you feel younger?
Gave me an extra dose of vigor. Then.
Anecdotal reports indicate the sisters are feeling better. The convent's director of health has taken note of fewer lung problems and better mobility. She attributes the sisters' improved condition to the fresh air exchange system and the architect's attention to geriatric needs. In another wing of the building, the high school kids say their health is on the upswing too.
You feel better. You feel better coming to school and breathing.
All the floor in the building have like very low volatile organic compounds, which those VOCs are, you know, produce the allergens, and they have almost next to none. So it's very clean.
Sister Mary Francine Horos is the principal at Our Lady of the Sacred Heart High School. She says students are making this connection between their health and environment because teachers have included the renovation in their curricula.
We've had people coming in, talking to the environmental science class, talking to the earth science class, and the physics class. And so some of the students are starting to understand how the whole environment is better because of the commitment we've made within our building.
Sister Mary Francine says students are using their green education outside the classroom. Angelo Caputo agrees.
I take it with me to work. I work at a gas station, and they were not environmentally friendly before. I've definitely gotten that to change.
The Felician sisters say that change is good. The sisters and their students are recycling, learning the ins and outs of composting, and spreading the word of their green, sustainable building. Sister Mary Christopher Moore believes their leap of faith has worked.
I think we took a kind of a risk. And I think that's one of the ways you know that God's leading you, because it turns out to be the right thing.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Ann Murray.
Thanks for joining us here at the Allegheny Front. Please send your comments or ideas to the Allegheny Front, 2313 East Carson Street, Pittsburgh, PA, 15203. Or you can email us. The email address is info@alleghenyfront.org. The executive producer of the Allegheny Front is Kathy Naur. Our technical director is Tim Prevost. And Tim also wrote and performed our theme music. Our programs are archived and available on WYEP.org. Our thanks go out to the Heinz Endowment, the Laurel Foundation, and the Snee Reinhardt Charitable Foundation for their kind support. I'm Matthew Craig. Please join us again next week for another edition of the Allegheny Front. That's Wednesday evening at 7 or Saturday morning at 6:30. So until then, go well with good blessings.